All right, good morning. How is everyone? It's good to see you all here today. So we're still in Hebrews. Can you believe we're 11 chapters in to this book? It's been a great study so far. We got a lot to cover today, so I'm just going to go ahead and pray, and then we'll get into our text and get our study started. God, thanks for the opportunity to come up here today. It's truly an honor to be able to teach your word, to read through it with this group of people and see what we can get out of it. I pray that you would speak to our hearts today and show us how we can learn to live by faith and trust you. And I just pray that your message of grace and salvation through your son is clear today, both in the teaching and any comments or sharing afterwards. Amen. All right. Like I said, Hebrews chapter 11, verses 22 through 29. So we're kind of winding down our study. We've got a few more weeks in this, and this book has been primarily about the finished work of Christ throughout. So what I mean by that is all the things that needed to be accomplished for us to have a relationship with God have been taken care of by Jesus. He's fulfilled the law and the whole Old Testament ritual system. All of that stuff is now obsolete. Jesus took care of it all. So now we can have a relationship with God through his son. In this chapter that we're studying today, over the past couple weeks, what we found out is it's all about faith. So we're going to see some more of that today. Adam Kelly got us started two or three weeks ago, back in the first part of chapter one, and made it clear to us that faith is not about hoping that things work out or believing real hard. It's not blind faith. It's faith, like it says in these first couple verses, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. There should be assurance and certainty in our faith. It shouldn't be irrational. It shouldn't be blind faith. So to drive this point home in the rest of chapter 11, we're given a list of people that were prominently featured in the Old Testament who lived by faith. We refer to this chapter in Scripture as like the Faith Hall of Fame. So we're going to look at a couple of these Hall of Famers today. A big point for us to take away from today, though, is to see how we shouldn't fixate on things that are seen or our circumstances. Those things are temporary, like it says here in 2 Corinthians. We fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary. What is unseen is eternal. Regardless of what circumstances we find ourselves in, whether it's times of trouble or maybe it's times of prosperity, the things that we experience around us, they're temporary. They're going away. What's important for us to understand is who the object of our faith is. The unseen is the eternal God that we worship. And that's Jesus. So we're going to draw this idea of seen and unseen out of us as we go through this study today. So the Hall of Famers that we're going to look at are Joseph and Moses, and also Moses's mother. There's definitely something that we can learn from her as well as we look back in the Old Testament. So we're going to be doing a lot of reviewing the Old Testament today. So the Hebrews passage that we're studying is kind of our base of operations, but I'm going to have a lot of Old Testament stuff on the screen up here, and it'll be kind of an abridged version, so it might be kind of challenging to try to keep up. So just watch on screen and kind of stay put there in Hebrews. So what's important to understand, again, as we progress through this book, is that the audience of this book are Hebrew Christians. These are people that know who Joseph and Moses are. They're very familiar with these two characters. They know all about what they did. So this is something that the audience can certainly connect with. And these Old Testament stories also make one other thing clear, is that all of this that we're going to learn happened before the law was given, before the ritual system was established, and God still acted on these people's faith. So that's an important takeaway for us, because the Hebrew Christians that were the audience of this letter are feeling drawn back to that way of life, that ritual system, that relating to God through the law. So we start out in Hebrews 11:22. It says, by faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. So we're going to have to explore the Old Testament to really find out what this story is about. And if you are familiar with the story of Joseph, you know that there's a lot to it. And this is the only mention that the author makes of Joseph in Hebrews. So I'm kind of surprised he doesn't spend a little bit more time on it. So let's get into what that story is. Just to set it up a little bit, he's the son of Jacob, the grandson, actually the great-grandson of Abraham, who, as we know, is the father of the Hebrew nation. So we learned last week from Kendall's teaching that Abraham was a man that God promised he would make into a great nation, and that all the people in the world would be blessed through him. And Joseph is his great-grandson. He's also Jacob's favorite son, and his brothers hate that. He's favored by his father. He was born to his father in his old age, to his favorite wife, so he has a special place in his heart. But Joseph had this habit of sharing these dreams that he had about how he would one day be ruling over his brothers and his mother and his father, so that didn't really sit well with the rest of his family. So that's kind of the thing that spawned their hatred. So we're going to jump back to Genesis 37, and I'm going to read through his story. Starting in verse 3, it says, now Israel, which is another name for Jacob, loved Joseph more than any of his other sons because he had been born to him in his old age, and he made an ornate robe for him. When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field when suddenly my sheaf rose up and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it. His brother said to him, do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us? And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. So as if that's not enough, Joseph had another dream. And he told it to his brothers. Listen, he said, like they want to hear. Oh, tell us your next dream. Listen, he said, I had another dream, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, what is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down on the ground before you? So his brothers are fed up with this. They don't like this. He's an annoying little brother. So one day, Jacob sends Joseph out to check on his brothers who are out tending the flocks in the fields, and they see him coming, and they decide, we're going to take care of this problem. We're going to deal with this Joseph once and for all. So they see him coming from a distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. So they're really going to take care of the problem. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of the cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. So they threw him in a cistern. But as they sat down to eat their meal, they hadn't killed him, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Judah said to his brothers, now, what are we going to gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay a hand on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. And they all agreed. Well, that's a way better plan, right? Only slightly worse than the first one. So when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern that they had placed him in and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites who took him to Egypt. So they've rid themselves of the Joseph problem. But now they have to figure out what they're going to do about telling Dad where Joseph is. So they come up with a plan to take the fancy coat that his father had given him. They dip it in blood, probably tatter it up a little bit. And they go back and tell his father that he was killed by wild animals. And his father believes this, and he's distraught. Meanwhile, Joseph has been sold into slavery. He's on his way to Egypt, where the Ishmaelites actually sell him to an Egyptian official named Potiphar, an official that's pretty high up in Pharaoh's administration. So we pick it back up in Genesis 39, verse 2. The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So for the life of a slave, this ain't half bad. He's been sold twice, and now he's a house manager and one of the most powerful people in Egypt's house. So not bad so far, considering the circumstances. But things take another turn for the worse. Turns out he caught the eye of Potiphar's wife. It says in our next segment here, Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." Apparently that's her pickup line. But he refused. "How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Now note that language there. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? You know, think of his circumstances. He's honoring God in this situation. He's not saying, "How could I break this rule? You know, Potiphar told me, don't sleep with my wife. Don't break that number." No, he's honoring God in this situation. This would be a sinful thing for me to do, even in his circumstances. He's still giving God the faith that he deserves. While she persists, one day he went into the house to attend his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." Again, her pickup line. But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed." When his master heard the story his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me," he burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. So I think this is kind of an interesting turn. He's put in prison. Now this is a Hebrew slave, a foreigner in Egypt, accused of attempted rape. He's not given a death sentence. It's kind of interesting. You would have thought Potiphar could have easily justified sentencing him to death. Maybe he's gained enough favor with Potiphar that he's going to overlook an accusation like this. I don't know. Maybe Potiphar's wife had a reputation and Potiphar wasn't surprised. I don't know. The text doesn't tell us. Regardless, I think the point here is Joseph, in another bad situation, still comes through. I think God's hand is still at work here. So on to the next adventure for Joseph, put in prison. While Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison. And he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. So, another silver lining in an otherwise cloudy day for Joseph. So if you got to be in prison, I suppose running it is probably your best scenario there. So this is going to lead us to another story. While he's basically the warden of the prison, he has an opportunity to meet two other individuals who happen to be servants of Pharaoh. The Pharaoh's chief cupbearer and the Pharaoh's chief baker, who have seemingly easy jobs, somehow find a way to offend Pharaoh enough in those jobs that they get thrown in prison too. So I don't know what you have to do as the cupbearer to get thrown in prison, but he found a way. Over some time, I'm sure Joseph had gotten to know who these guys were, and he noticed one day that they were both sad. So he went up and he asked them, "You know, why do you look so sad?" Here was their response. "We both had dreams," they answered, "but there is no one to interpret them." Then Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell me your dreams." Again, no credit given to God here. Still has his eyes on God in this situation. So the chief cupbearer told Joseph his dream. He said to him, "In my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup, and put the cup in his hand." "This is what it means," Joseph said to him. "The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your position. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand, just as you used to do when you were his cupbearer. But when all goes well with you, please remember me. Show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh. Get me out of this prison." Not a bad idea. He's lobbying for his release here. "I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I've done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon." So we have the chief baker. When the chief baker saw that Joseph had given a favorable interpretation, he said to Joseph, "I too had a dream. On my head there were three baskets of bread. In the top basket were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head." "This is what it means," Joseph said. "The three baskets are 3 days. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head and impale your body on a pole, and the birds will eat away your flesh." Not as favorable of an interpretation. So both of these dreams actually come true. 3 days later, actually, at the Pharaoh's birthday party of all places, Pharaoh restored the chief cupbearer to his position so that once again he put a cup into Pharaoh's hand. But he impaled the chief baker, just as Joseph had said to him in his interpretation. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He's still there in the prison, still running the show, but still in prison. So he's in there for 2 more years, and then he gets another chance. Pharaoh had a couple dreams. Picking it up in Genesis 41, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile when out of the river there came 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. After them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile and stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek, fat cows. He fell asleep again and had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted and then scorched, thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy, full heads. Pharaoh couldn't find anyone in his kingdom to interpret these dreams. So it's at this point, then, the cupbearer remembers Joseph. Maybe he was just waiting for the right time, but this is it. He says, "I know a guy. I met a guy in prison." So they decide, well, nobody else can do it, so let's get Joseph out of the prison. They clean him up, shave his head, make him look like an Egyptian, and they bring him in to Pharaoh so they can find out what he has to say. Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I had a dream, and no one can interpret it. But I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." "I cannot do it," Joseph replied to Pharaoh, "but God will give Pharaoh the answer that he desires." Again, credit to God, right? He's got his eyes on God, even in all of these circumstances. He hasn't taken his eyes off of God. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 good cows are 7 years, and the 7 good heads of grain are 7 years. It is one and the same dream. The 7 lean, ugly cows that came up afterward are 7 years, and so are the 7 worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind. They are 7 years of famine. It is just as I said to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. 7 years of great abundance are coming throughout the land of Egypt, but 7 years of famine will follow them. Then all of the abundance in Egypt will be forgotten, and the famine will ravage the land. The abundance in the land will not be remembered because the famine that follows it will be so severe. The reason the dream was given to Pharaoh in 2 forms is that the matter has been firmly decided by God, and God will do it soon. And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during those 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming up and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in the cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt, so that the country may not be ruined by the famine. Well, who do you think they picked as the wise and discerning man to be in charge of the land of Egypt? Joseph is now selected as this person. He's in charge. He's second in command only to Pharaoh himself. He's about 30 years old. The last 13 years of his life has been rejection by his family, twice sold as a slave, put in prison, and here he is now in a very, very powerful position. Pharaoh gives him a wife. He has two children, Manasseh and Ephraim. And it's interesting, if you read the text, you can see that there's meaning behind the names of his two children as well. Again, he's got his eyes on God. He named Manasseh that name because God has made me forget all my trouble. And Ephraim, God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. Again, his eyes are on God, the object of his faith. And he finds himself in the position of power to save a nation. Egypt will be sustained through this plan that Joseph came up with. After years of confusion and waiting, he's finally seeing something unravel in front of him, a plan unravel in front of him. You ever feel that way? You never know what's coming. You wait a long time. But you look at his history, and for a guy who can't catch a break, he sure caught a lot of them along the way. You can see God's hand guiding him through this. And maybe that's what we need to do sometimes when we find ourselves in times of struggle and strife, is to look back over that time and see if there are things where we can say God was involved in that sort of thing. And I think we can do that in Joseph's story. Now, Canaan, where his family is from, they're not exempt from this famine. They're affected as well. And Jacob, Joseph's father, hears that there's grain in Egypt. So 2 years into the famine, this is what happens. Genesis 42, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you just keep looking at each other? I don't know what that's all about. He continued, I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. This is a really long story, and we don't have time to get into it. But I can tell you that at the end of it, Joseph sees that the plan has fallen into place. It all makes sense. So we're going to jump ahead to the end of it. Throughout this whole ordeal, Joseph has kept his faith. He's kept his eyes on God. He's seen plans in the recent years develop where he can see that he's being used. But he had no idea really what God was up to ultimately all this time. But now it's become clear, and he forgave his brothers. Take a look at the end of this story, Genesis 45:4. Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. Again, they didn't recognize him because he looked like an Egyptian and had been, 15 years or so, I believe. Come close to me. When they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So this is Joseph, the slave, has an opportunity now to save Israel. He's in this unique position as second in command to Pharaoh himself, to lobby Pharaoh to bring his family down to Egypt, where they can have access not only to him but to the resources that they have there in Egypt. And Pharaoh agrees. This little family was about 70 people at the time, Joseph's brothers and his fathers and their families. And he's now seeing how he's being used to save that nation. Not through anything that he had done. He just maintained his faith and kept his eyes on God, and God is working through that, through Joseph, through his circumstances. Our base passage, Hebrews 11, verse 22, says, by faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions concerning the burial of his bones. You may remember from Kendall's teaching last week that part of that promise that God made to Abraham was not just to bless the world through him and make him into a great nation, but to give him the land of Canaan, that belongs to your people. And Joseph believed that. Now he's got hope based on evidence and seeing how God had worked through his circumstances that God will deliver on that promise as well. So he wants to go back when they go back. So he gives them instructions, take my bones with me when you go back. So that's a message that he gave them. He was now living for the unseen. Our Hebrews text now shifts over to Moses. So it says, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So let's set the stage. This is centuries past the story of Joseph. Hundreds of years have passed now. The old generation has died off, or Joseph's gone, all of his brothers are gone, Jacob's gone. But the Israelites are still in Egypt. That little band of 70 people in Joseph's family is now over 1 million strong at this point. They've multiplied and multiplied over the last several centuries. But there's a new king. There's a new pharaoh now, obviously, centuries later. And he didn't have any regard for Joseph or his people. In fact, he viewed the Hebrews as a threat to the kingdom of Egypt. So much of a threat that he enslaved them, he oppressed them, persecuted them, even to the point of giving this edict that we see mentioned in 11:23 in Hebrews, where all the Hebrew baby boys are to be murdered. They're to be thrown into the Nile River and destroyed. So we're probably familiar with the story of Moses' birth, I would guess. Most people are familiar with that. We have the baby Moses in the basket right out on the Nile River. His parents didn't want to kill him. They didn't want to follow the Pharaoh's command. But there's really kind of two interpretations or viewpoints on this that I want to take you through. And I think through that, we'll see the kind of faith that Moses' mother had in this situation. So here's one of the interpretations of that story. Moses' mother puts him in a basket, and she shoves him out onto the Nile River, the surging Nile River, one of the biggest, I think it's the biggest river in the world, hoping that nothing bad would happen, hoping that something good would happen. Well, I have a friend at work. I love this. He says this all the time. Hope is not a strategy. This is that thing Adam talked about a couple weeks ago. We're not talking about, boy, I hope the weather's good, or I hope my team wins, or something like that. We're not talking about that kind of hope. And that's what this is. This interpretation is that any different? Shoving him out on the Nile River, is that any different than really just throwing him in? It's not. That's blind faith. It's not reasonable. No thought involved. I would call this like a super spiritual faith. This is the whole let go and let God mentality. Everything's up to God. I'm not going to do anything. There's no action. There's no planning. It's very unreasonable faith. But if you look at the story of Moses' birth and what his parents did, it's real clear that it's different than this kind of faith. Exodus chapter 2. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. This is one of the Hebrew babies, she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, she must have been hiding in the reeds somewhere, and pops out, very clever, shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you? Pretty good plan, I think. Yes, she answered, go. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you. So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, I drew him out of the water. Well, that's a story where they had a plan. They thought it through. They developed a plan based on what they could see. They knew where Pharaoh's daughter would go to bathe, and they were hoping, based on evidence in front of them, that this would work out. God combined his actions with their actions, with their faith in this case. Was there a risk? Sure, they didn't know necessarily how Pharaoh's daughter would respond, but they did take that risk, but it was based on trust combined with their action. And this is more representative of true spiritual faith. It shouldn't be irrational. God has his part, that's true. That is absolutely true, but so do we. We should act as well. And he'll act through our faith. Getting back into Hebrews 11:24, at some point, Moses comes to understand who he is, and it has a profound impact on him. He realizes that he's one of these Hebrews that he sees that are enslaved around him. It says in 11:24, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. By faith, he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who was invisible. So if you think about Moses' position, he's got it made. He lives in the Pharaoh's family. Pharaoh's daughter is his mother. But he sees all this oppression of his people around him, and he's got to do something. That stuff isn't as important to him. He just can't turn his head from it. And I think that's something that we can learn from. James 4:17 says, if anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. I think there's some application in this for us. You know, we can't ignore the plight of the poor and the oppressed and the sick around us, and they're everywhere. It's a sin to do that. And I think this is the motivation that Moses had when he made this decision, not to turn a blind eye anymore. He wanted to be used by God in this situation, but he didn't know how. And that becomes clear when you see what his first action was once he came to this realization, which set off a chain of events where we see God's plan unfold. Getting back to Exodus chapter 2, one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting a fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. And Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian. So here's an example of a story where human action did not involve faith in God. It did not involve waiting to see where God guided you, finding out what God wanted you to do, God showing you the way. He just did it his way. And his way and our way, those aren't the right ways. Proverbs 14:12 says, "There is a way that seems right to man, but in the end it leads to death." Moses' actions weren't God's way, and as a result, he had to flee Egypt. Now he was a wanted man. And for 40 years, he spent time tending his flocks in the wilderness, away from all that wealth that he had at his fingertips before. All the while, the Hebrews are still under the slavery in Egypt, under all that oppression. So what's the plan? 40 years. What is God doing? Why this wait? You ever feel that way sometimes? Why am I waiting? When is God going to act? When is he going to do something? And I think sometimes we have to reach a point of brokenness where we're free of all of the distractions that keep our eyes focused on other things, like in Moses' case. All that he had is behind him now. And before God can truly use us, sometimes we have to leave all that behind. And there's certainly, I'm sure, some character development in Moses over that time. We don't get a lot of detail. But we can see that God does take action. He hears the cries of the Israelites in their slavery, and he calls Moses. Back in Hebrews 11:28, it says, "By faith he kept the Passover and the application of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel." So we need to go back and find out what all this is about. Back into Exodus chapter 3. "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And Moses said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, 'I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey.'" That's that land of Canaan that God promised Abraham. "And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." Now, I'm sure you can understand Moses is probably a little freaked out by this. Last time he was in Egypt, he was a wanted man. That's 40 years ago. He's around 80 years old at this point. And God is telling him, "You're going to go back in and you're going to demand that Pharaoh release my people." God promises to be with him, and that's great and all, but Moses is still a little bit timid about this, and God gives him some signs and some miracles to encourage him, and he even gives him his brother as a spokesperson and a support system to go and do this with him. So eventually Moses agrees, and his brother Aaron goes with him, and they go to Pharaoh, and they start this plea that God would let the Israelites go, or that Pharaoh would let the Israelites go. So we have this encounter between Moses and Pharaoh. So not surprisingly, Pharaoh is not really inclined to go along with this plan to let his slave labor force go. He's got a million people working for him. He's not just going to let him go easily. But here's what is surprising. Moses, a wanted man, a member of the nation that is enslaved, and his brother, they walk away from this situation. Don't you think Pharaoh could have dealt with him on the spot, killed him? "I don't need to deal with you." But he didn't. This is the king of the greatest nation in the known world at this time, all the power that there was to have. Yet they walk away. I think this is another example of God being in control, and he's protecting him because he's got plans for him. So Pharaoh says no, and then God goes on to inflict a series of plagues on the nation of Israel, or a nation of Egypt. And this is another long story that unfortunately we just don't have a lot of time to get into, but he demonstrates his power and control with all of these plagues. And then there's a final plague that God inflicts on Egypt, and that's the one that will result ultimately in their release from captivity. And that is a plague on their firstborn. Back to Exodus chapter 12. "The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, 'Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and the tops of the door frames of the houses where they are to eat the lambs. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of the people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. This is the day that you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance." So Moses told the Israelites, gave them these instructions, and they followed him. There is something else here that I want to take on as an aside. just briefly. This event describes the first Passover. Passover is an event that's still celebrated today. And this is that event where God's going to go through and he's going to judge Egypt for their sin, killing their firstborn. But the believers, the Israelites, that responded to this instruction and did what Moses said, they're going to be passed over and their firstborn are going to be spared. And Jesus was the Passover lamb. Ultimately, this all was about Jesus. It was a foreshadowing. Jesus was the Passover lamb. John the Baptist in the Gospels, when he sees Jesus coming, he says, "Look, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." He is the unseen that the prophets had anticipated and written about. This is the unseen that Moses regarded. You know, they knew that God was going to deliver them. And this, again, this first Passover was a foreshadowing of God's ultimate rescue plan, which was salvation through his son, Jesus. Back to the story. At midnight, the Lord struck down all of the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock. Pharaoh and his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up, leave my people. Get out of here. Go. Take your flocks and your herd and leave." The Israelites journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth. There were about 600,000 men on foot besides women and children. Now the length of time the Israelite people lived in Egypt was 430 years. At the end of 430 years to the very day, all the Lord's people, all the Lord's divisions left Egypt. And there's more action. Back to Hebrews 11:29. By faith the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. Everybody knows this story. The Israelites, they're going to pass through. The reason that they're going to do this is because Pharaoh comes to his senses and realizes he's lost his slave labor force. He's not into that, so he musters his army and he's going to pursue them. So here we have the Israelites with the Red Sea in front of them. They fled Egypt. They've got Pharaoh's army behind them. And God works through Moses and provides the Israelites safe passage through the Red Sea on dry ground. The Egyptians, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, horsemen and troops, pursued the Israelites and overtook them. As Pharaoh approached, the Israelites looked up and there were Egyptians marching after them. They were terrified and cried out to the Lord. Moses answered the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm and you'll see the deliverance of the Lord. The Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only be still." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to move on. Raise your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide the water so the Israelites can go through the sea on dry ground." Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with strong east wind and turned it into dry land. The waters were divided. And the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their left and on their right. And that must have been quite the supernatural sight to behold, I'm guessing. I can't read this story without thinking of this scene from the movie Bruce Almighty.
Here's your soup.
Oh, soup, right. Yeah, right.
All right, so it wasn't red tomato soup that that Moses parted, but same concept on a much, much larger scale, though. Separated the waters, and the Israelites walked through on dry ground. The Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters flow back over the Egyptians and their chariots and horsemen." Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at daybreak the sea went back to its place. The Egyptians were fleeing toward it, and the Lord swept them into the sea. The water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh and all that had followed the Israelites into the sea. None of them survived. Pretty stiff consequences for fighting against God, I would say. And when the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and Moses, his servant. So what we've been looking at today are a series of rescue plans that God has instituted. Joseph, when we look back at him, despite his suffering, he kept his faith. Went through a lot of bad circumstances, and God worked through him in those circumstances. And all the while, he credited God. He honored God, even in bad situations. Moses' mother didn't have a lot of options. The edict from Pharaoh was to kill all Hebrew baby boys. But she thought through it and trusted that God would come through and act on the faith that she expressed and rescue Moses for what he had planned for her or for him. So he combined her faith with his action, and it was a reasonable faith. And again, Moses, against all odds, a wanted man, one man, goes back and leads a nation out of captivity. He did what he thought was right. He was honest with God, and God gave him signs and miracles and encouragement to get him through it, demonstrated his power and control over the situation. So some different and distinct ways that we can look at these characters and see what kind of faith that they expressed and how God worked through it. And ultimately, the last rescue plan is the ultimate one. It's Jesus, the Passover lamb. This was always God's plan to save everyone, these people that we talked about today and us through his son Jesus. When God saw the blood on the door frames during that first Passover, and he passed over those houses and the people there were spared, he looks at us, those of us that have invited Christ into our lives and allowed his blood to pay for our sins. He sees that blood the same way, and he passes over us in terms of judgment. We're excused from God's judgment. We have an eternal relationship with him. Colossians chapter 1, 13 and 14 says that God has rescued us from the dominion of darkness through his son. For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And he's adopted us into his family as his children. And this is a reminder for the Hebrew Christians reading this letter, and for us. We have always been saved by faith, by God's grace. Says in Ephesians 2, 8, 9, "For it is by grace you have been saved through faith. This is not from yourselves. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast." So I ask you, why return to a way of relating to God that's based on the law and works and ritual system? And that's the question posed to these Hebrew Christians when we always were saved by faith, as illustrated by these stories today, before the law and the ritual system were in place. God offers us a gift of salvation through his son. There is no ritual. There is no work to be done. It's already been done on the cross, the finished work of Christ. We simply need to admit that we need his salvation and come to him in humility and agree that, yeah, I want your son's death and the blood that he shed to be the payment for my sin so that I can have that relationship with you. So that's where we're going to leave it today. If you are a first-time guest here, we are glad that you're here. We have a free book to give you if you want to stop in at the welcome table after our meeting. And we have a welcome card in your bulletin that you got as you walked through the door. If you have any feedback, please feel free to fill out that form and drop it in the basket as it comes by. And if you're a new guest here, we'd love to hear what you think of the meeting. We read all of these comments, and we'd love to know what we can do better. There is going to be a bag passed around to support the financial needs of the church. So if this is your home church and you want to help us run this ministry and keep the lights on, this is your opportunity to do so. But if you're a guest, we ask you to pass that hat on by. We'd rather just get your feedback on the card. If you have children in Oasis, they're there for almost 20 more minutes. So please pick them up by 11:45 so that the teachers back there can come out and join us. And if you have any questions or comments, please raise your hand. I would like to invite you. Hopefully you saw something in there that made you think of a time in your life where you had to really exercise your faith. So if you have something that you're willing to share regarding a moment where your faith was really tested and you weren't sure what God was going to do, and you have maybe something at the end of that story, or maybe you're in it right now, I'd invite you to share that during the Q&A session. So if you have a question or a comment, just raise your hand and somebody will bring you a mic.
I really like the statement you put up there that faith equals trust plus action. And I don't think there's any area that this is more appropriate than helping other people understand what God's offer is. I mean, when Jesus was here, he said, I'm going to build my church. And each of us has a role to do that. And that involves a couple of things. First of all, we have to trust that God is out there drawing and convicting and opening the eyes of people's hearts, getting them ready to hear the gospel. But then there's an action, too. We have to step up, and we have to talk to people. If people are going to understand the gospel offer, they're going to have to hear it verbally most of the time. And that's where we come in. Exercising faith in this area is whatever fear I have, whatever hesitation I have, I'm going to trust that God is working in the hearts of some of the people I'm around, and I'm going to step up, and I'm going to act. I'm going to share with them in as gracious a way as I can, trusting that God is going to do his thing.
Yeah, great, great illustration. I agree with you 100%. Over here.
I think as you were going through these stories, I was really being convicted more on how little faith I have. You know, I can be talking to God about something and a week goes by and I get so impatient, you know. It's like, well, he's not going to answer my prayers or whatever. When these great examples to us, you know, 40 years, whatever, mm-hmm. in prison, all this, you know, and they still have that faith. And so I'm so very grateful for the grace of God that, you know, he still loves me even with my little faith. And that's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's why it's important to reflect back on things. And I know some people in here have ways that they remember where God's come through, whether it's a prayer journal or maybe they've got things that remind of them, pictures or trinkets or whatever that help them to remind them of things that God's done in their lives, just to kind of bolster that faith. But you can be in the midst of something and have that oh poor me or just that spiritual lull and not really realize that God is working. So it's something that you have to tune into. And yeah, thank you. Anybody else?
Yeah, I have a story to share about. Gosh, this was in 1985 and. I was a fairly new believer, and I was getting ready to go through a divorce. And it was a really hard time, you know. And I knew God was there. I didn't know how he was going to come through or what my life was going to look like or anything. But I remember that year, and I always think of it right around this time, because I took my son down to Red, White, and Boom, and the next day I went to the grocery store, and I went to pay for my groceries, and I didn't have my wallet. And it ended up that I had lost it at the fireworks. And if you guys have been there, you know there's a lot of people. So I was driving my little Chevette with no air conditioning and talking to the Lord, because my divorce was going to be like 3 days later, July the 8th. And I'm like, Lord, I don't know. I don't know why this is going on. I don't know what you're doing in me or what's going to happen here. So I drive my little Chevette down to where I was sitting at Red, White, and Boom. And I went walking over there, and there was my wallet on the ground. And everything was in it, which wasn't much, but that's beside the point. I was like, it sounds really weird, but it was like God affirming to me, don't forget I'm with you, and I can act, and I can bring things about, and learn to trust me. That was like 30-some years ago, and I always remember it this time of year, because Red, White, and Boom, and that, but it's like, I feel like it's one of my monuments that God gave me of his faithfulness. So.
Yeah, that's great. That's the word I was looking for, a monument, you know, in your history. That's a great one. My wife told me this morning that some friends of ours are looking into adoption. Anybody that's ever gone through that knows that there's a lot of expenses related to that. And they're talking pretty seriously about it, and they know that they have a $10,000 expense that's coming up very soon. And they have some other financial concerns, and they're not sure where the money's going to come from. And my wife got a text last night and talked to the lady this morning, the friend of ours, and it turns out that they had a mysterious deposit in their bank account yesterday of $9,400 in their bank account, and they had no idea what it was from. So they did a little bit of research, and they found out that a company that her husband had worked for like over a decade ago owed him money. They had no idea. They'd forgotten all about this thing. That stuff pops into their bank account yesterday. So you just never know. You know, you sit and you wait. When are you going to do something? When are you going to act? And we don't appreciate or understand or know what God's timing is, but he does. And this is, I mean, it's a monument for them. I mean, they're like doing cartwheels. My wife is doing cartwheels. she's loving it. It's a great story, so... Yeah, that's cool. Thank you for sharing that. Right up front.
I think one of the hardest things is when year after year and these decade-long periods of waiting and maybe you don't see anything. And I think our tendency is to get bitter, either at God or at the people that caused the situation. And at the end of Genesis, Joseph's talking to his brothers because his brothers are afraid that, you know, this is after the old man dies, and he's afraid that, you know, you're secretly bitter to us, and now you're going to kill us off. And this is what Joseph says. He says, don't be afraid, for am I in God's place? In other words, God's going to judge how God wants to. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people.
Yeah.
And so we see, you know, just that temptation to be bitter at his brothers. He turned that over to God, to let God handle, and then that freed him up to be, you know, loving to his brothers. And then to actually, bitterness can keep you from fulfilling what this big plan is that God has for you.
Yeah.
Because like one of the things that struck me when Joseph was in prison, his heart had not gotten so bittered. He sees those dreamer, the two guys, and he's worried about them.
Right.
You guys are sad. And I'm like going, wow, that's a tenderness of his heart that he kept, rather than letting the difficult circumstances embitter his heart towards people, towards the offender, and then ultimately towards God.
Yeah. Yeah, that bitterness thing is unhealthy. I've heard somebody say bitterness is the pill you swallow to get even with the other person. It only has an effect on you. It doesn't do anything to them. And it's damaging. And it does prohibit you if you let it take over. It prohibits you from being able to forgive and to fulfill your purpose. Yeah. Another one here.
When I think of this passage, I think of a time, a monument, if you would, where I first found out I was pregnant. And the doctor, my doctor just given me some medicine before I knew I was pregnant that would actually kill the baby or make the baby where the spine would be on the outside of the body. So my doctor had asked me to abort the baby. When I was 18, I had an abortion. That's what led me to Christ, and I wasn't going to do that again. But it was really challenging because we didn't know if we was going to, the baby would die. We didn't know if we was going to have to deal with a severely handicapped baby the rest of our lives, and if we were mature enough to do that, because that would be our mission in life, to take care of that kid. And so I hung on to the verse, Hebrews 11:6. It says, "And it is impossible to please God without faith. Anybody who wants to come to him must believe that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him." And I just had to focus on God is good no matter what the outcome, whether the baby dies, whether our life is to take care of a handicapped child, God is good. And that was at the beginning of my pregnancy. I, you know, struggled with anxiety over the whole 9 months. But turned out the baby was healthy, you know, smart as a whip. But it was a lesson in faith the whole 9 months I was pregnant that I had to trust that God had a plan.
Yeah.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, what an awesome monument. Thank you for sharing. All right, well, we have a few minutes before we have to pick the kids up. So if you